The mules are in the corral. Welcome to Mule Talk, and I'm Cindy K. Roberts, your host.
And our author, TV personality, and world-renowned mule trainer, Meredith Hodges of the Lucky Three Ranch.
Happy April Fool's Day, Meredith.
Happy April Fool's Day to you, too.
Okay.
We actually wrote a book about April Fool's Day. It was the last book in the Jasper the Mule series, and it's called Jasper and April Mule's Day.
All right.
And yeah, we didn't get the DVD done because that was just going to be a lot of too much extra work and money at the time.
Sure.
But this book was a really clever one. And we thought that the joke would be Jasper was looking forward to being in the parade with the 20 mule team. And they were supposed to come to the ranch, the Happy Valley Ranch, and meet everybody and overnight there. And then they were all going to go to the parade the next day. But as it turned out, Ben told Kylie that he had some really bad news for her and that the 20 mule team was not going to show up.
Mm.
And she was all bummed out about it and everything. And so they were all looking at the mules in the pasture and talking and stuff like that. And all of a sudden they heard some bells coming down the road. And they looked down the road and here comes the 20 mule team. Bells ringing and Kylie turns around to her father and dad. You know, he was kidding. And he goes, April, Mule's Day!
Oh!
And so it was a really cute book that we put together, and of course Bonnie Shields did the illustration,
cool. As
she always does for me with the Jasper the Mule series. But we got to a point where the mules were coming off the road, the 20 mule team was coming off the road and making a 90-degree angle turn into the driveway. And there's a very specific way that 20 mule team makes those kinds of turns. And the teams, the three teams, sometimes four teams out in front of the wagon the two right next to the wagon don't have to do this, and the ones right in front of them don't always have to. But those teams that are pulling that wagon, in order to get it around the corner so it doesn't fall into the ditch, it has to go straight for a while. So those mules have to jump the chain, is what they call it. If you're making a left turn, the ones on the left have to jump the chain and make that wagon go straight for a while the mules out in front of them are actually making the turn. And then when they get the wagon to the place where they have to make the turn, they jump back over the chain and make the turn. Well, that made for a very interesting illustration. And Bonnie and I actually got into a dispute about how that drawing was supposed to look. And so finally, you know, I go, well, they do it here like this, and I think you're a little wrong here in this drawing, and this mule ought to be here, and this one ought to be there. And she goes, no, Meredith, you're wrong. And so I said, well, how about we leave this dispute to a professional? So we sent the drawing to Bobby Tanner out in Bishop. And Bobby came back, and he goes, you're both wrong. Here's the way it's supposed to go. So we actually did that illustration in the Jasper and April Mule's Day book. That drawing in there is correct. And it is the way that they make those turns when they have to make those turns with that many animals out in front of that wagon. And I thought that was pretty cool. It was pretty cool. And that just goes to show you, too, that driving is not a cinch. It looks like it would be a really fun thing to do. And there are a lot of animals, particularly younger mules, that will take to it pretty easily from the beginning. As I have often told you, it's really important to get your groundwork in. And I don't mean just do it until they do it in your estimation. They really have to build up their bodies to do things correctly. Because this driving is still an athletic activity, and it's really important so that they don't strain the muscles in their body in any way, shape, or form, that those core muscles especially, and the elements, the tendons, the ligaments, and everything need to be developed symmetrically around the bones so that you don't have problems later, because if they get sore, they're going to react to it. And the thing about mules and driving is if they, if something happens and they become uncomfortable while they're driving, their first inclination is to bolt and run. And with that cart, you know, the first thing that happens to you is you get thrown out of the cart.
Oh, yeah.
And then they've got that thing bouncing behind them, and heaven help you if you're in a class at a show and they do something like that. Because then you have other people at risk that are around you, you know, because they're just, that cart is just creating everywhere. And I think I've told you the story about when I broke Lucky 3CG to drive as a three-year-old. She, I thought it was going to be easy, too, and I didn't put enough groundwork in with her. And what's even worse is I didn't wear my helmet. And I really, I surely did after that. Every time I was, you know, doing anything with a younger one, I put that helmet on. Because what happened to me, she bolted and ran in the indoor arena. I got thrown out of the cart and got knocked out. My head hit a post, and I got knocked out. But my husband said I was only out for a few minutes, and the mule was running around the arena. I actually stood up and went to get her, and I got her to stop by standing in front of her, and she stopped, and then I took the harness off and got her detached from the cart and everything, and then led her back to the barn, put her in the stall, and then passed out again, and he had to take me to the hospital. I was out all day long, but I had the wherewithal to take care of my mule before myself. I've always been like that.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
Another incident, you know, that I had too, I didn't, back in the same day, I had a miniature horse and I wanted to teach him to drive because I thought, oh, it would be nice to have a little mini team. And I had just bought Franklin from John and Stephanie Newton out of Bishop. And he was 20 years old when I got him. So I thought he'd be a really good one to pair up the miniature horse with and have him pull a marathon cart. I teamed them up together and thought I would have them pull a marathon cart together that was made for minis. I thought, well, Franklin's so solid, you know, Mirage, he'll get it. And I had driven Mirage single, and he had let me know that he wasn't really fond of it, but he would do it, you know. And so I thought, okay, well, he's ready. I've spent enough time on my groundwork, so I'm in the outdoor arena. And Franklin, I got him hitched and everything. Then I took Mirage in beside him. And I was hooking up all the harness and everything. And then I got it all hitched up. And I walked back towards the cart to kind of tie up the reins. We were going to, me and my assistant, we're going to lead them around with this thing first. And I no sooner got back by the seat than that pony just exploded. That little miniature horse just exploded.
Wow.
And wiggled his way out of his harness right there on the spot without going anywhere.
Oh.
I've never seen anything like that.
I'll be darned. Huh.
It was a total wreck, but I was very persistent, so I put him back in, tightened up the harness again. That also taught me that I really need to pay attention to how the harness is fitted, because he could throw it off.
Oh, sure.
And it wasn't tight enough, and, you know, in spots where it needed to be snug, but not tight, you know, and all of that. I learned a big lesson that day. But then, you know, me and Steve, we just went ahead and led him around the arena once. And I said, I think this is enough for the day. You know? And I may or may not ever drive this little miniature horse ever again. But then, you know, I thought, well, later on, I'll go ahead and get him another partner, because Franklin was 20 and he didn't really, he looked at me like I just did him wrong by hitching him up with this maniac, you know. And I thought, well, I'll go ahead and get more groundwork on Mirage. And then I bought a match for him, a little mini mule match called Frances. And she was another maniac.
Ooh.
So then I had two of them. You know, I'm one that, you know, I want to fit the animal to the job that I think they're best suited for. Those two were not suitable for driving. So I just gave it up. You know, it was fun having them around, and the people that came to the tours really liked them, and they were, you know, very well-mannered in their ground manners, and they like going through the trail course on the lead rope, over the bridge, you know, through the poles, over the tires, and jumping over things and stuff like that. And I wasn't going to show them anyway, so it really didn't matter. Now that they're both older, Frances is 22 and Raj is 28, and Raj is blind. So Frances now leads him around. he just follows Francis around, and that's her job. And Mirage is the cutesy little miniature horse representation of horses on the 11-3 ranch. Now that we've lost all the brood stock, you know, he's the only horse we have. So kind of nice to have him around. But it just really solidified the importance of groundwork and doing enough of it, because there are so many things that happen when you're doing groundwork, and especially when you start leading them through my hourglass pattern in their elbow pull in good posture that puts them in a good frame and develops their muscles correctly around the bones and the tendons and stuff. And then you don't see any arthritis when they age. Mirage is blind, but he has no arthritis at 28 years old.
Wow.
It's the same thing with all my mules that have gone through this program. And now most of the mules are there's two at 28 years old, and everybody else is between the age of 30 and 33.
Okay.
And there's not a hint of arthritis in any of them. See, the other thing that happens when you do that, they learn a lot of different things besides just the physical conditioning. They learn how to be totally attentive to you, how to bond with you. They identify the fact that you care about them, so they don't think that anything that would cause them to spook ordinarily is something to spook at until they check with you, you know. So the bolting and running completely disappears. And that is a really, really nice thing, especially when you're driving. Because driving, if you think riding is a hazard, driving is 10 times that hazard. And a lot of people think just because you can drive a car, you can fly an airplane, you know, but that's not necessarily true, as people find out later. And it's the same thing when you're driving these animals, you know. You think you know how to get up there and hold the lines and everything, and as long as they go forward, you can steer them and all that. And they oversimplify things. You have to learn how to give rewards the right way for every step of the way with driving training. And with any kind of training, you know, a lot of people will go out, you know, and they'll do all the groundwork and everything, and they give them oats at the end, and they think that's good enough. But see, you're not rewarding the specific behaviors that you're teaching. They need that food reward to say, yes, this is the way I want you to respond to this movement, this situation. And that's what gets them to really pay attention to you and learn how to stop whenever there's a question. They will stop. They learn to stop, square up, look at you, and ask you what you want. And that's what you want them to be like when you're getting into driving. You have to make sure that you're both ready to go on to the actual driving training so that you can identify if this animal is going to be a good candidate for driving before you hitch him up to the cart. If he pays attention to all these ground exercises, starting with the leading training, if he stops in the designated halt points, and he has learned to go ahead and set himself up four square without you telling him to do anything. You just turn around, get in your position, look at his shoulder, nod your head, and see if he goes ahead and is obedient. That's what you want him to do. That means he's a good learner, he learns quickly, and he internalizes everything that you are trying to teach him. You have to look at it from the equine's point of view. It's scary to have something rumbling behind you that you can't get away from. And 9 times out of 10, those driving bridles have blinkers on them. So he won't be able to see it either, even if he can hear it. So he really needs to be sensitive to your voice, your driving through the lines, and how your hands are, because he will pick up any tension that you have in your body through those lines. And it doesn't take much. They're hypersensitive to that kind of stuff. So when you do all these groundwork things, they should take a long time to make sure that he's really internalizing everything that you teach him. So you go ahead and you do the leading through the hourglass pattern. You do your lunging and lunging with a lunge line, which is also attached to the bit and your hand, and solidifying that connection. Then you add the lines and ground drive him in the round pen. And then you can make an assessment as to whether he's going to be a suitable candidate for driving or not. If you have a horse or a mule that you can't ride because he bucks or rears, probably would, and you think maybe he'll drive? Absolutely not.
No.
You know?
Right.
that you want your driving experience to be a safe one. You know, and so it's really important to spend that adequate time. And I've found that adequate time can be on the hourglass pattern is generally speaking 3 to 6 months, depending on the animal's experience. That's just doing the leading training in the hourglass pattern. Then it's another 3 to 6 months with obstacles added to the hourglass pattern. Afterwards, after you've done it, then you go do obstacles. And there's a specific way to do those. First, just getting through them, and then learning to stop and have your animal listen to you in the middle of the obstacles while maintaining their posture, their good posture. Then another 3 to 6 months on lunging in the round pen, and another 3 to 6 months on ground driving in the round pen. So you have prep work that's 2 years before you even think about riding or driving. And if you have a younger animal, sometimes if they are an appropriate candidate for driving, it's more fun to go ahead and further develop their muscles without the stress of a rider. A rider is a lot more complicated for the animal to deal with than learning to pull a cart with you in it. Because pulling the weight is easier than having it right straight on their back and affecting every balance move that they're trying to make. It's hard for them to adjust to that, but it's easier to adjust to being between the shafts. And in Mirage's case, you know, being with another animal, and a lot of times they will learn from the other animal how to be in harness. So I wouldn't say that you necessarily have to learn to drive single before you go double, because if you've got a good solid animal for them to drive with that has good habits, then they can learn those good habits from that other animal.
And if they are harnessed and pulling an ice cream wagon, they are real popular in their neighborhood.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we'll talk about that a little bit more, but there are a ton of driving activities available that do include your neighbors. One of them that we did.
Wow!
We went trick-or-treating.
We
decorated the wagon, and we all dressed up in costumes and trick-or-treated through the neighborhood. And the neighbors loved it. You know, and driving is a lot of fun. But before we even get to that point, I've seen in the shows that I've gone to and everything that there are a variety of ways that people put on the harness. And it's really important to get your harness adjusted properly, no matter what kind you're using. A lot of people think that, oh, gee, I don't like the blinders, so I'll use a bridle without it. Well, if you've got an animal with a hair trigger, that may not be the smart thing to do.
Yeah.
Yes, you can get them used to pulling the wagon or the cart behind them. But can you really get them used to having a kid coming out of nowhere right up the side and still keep them in line in a parade so they don't go sideways and run over all the spectators?
Right.
You know, it's not cruel to have blinders on those bridles. It helps them to be more focused and to stay that way regardless of the distractions. You've already done the groundwork to make them pay attention to you. If you spent that kind of time, you will have a good rapport with your animal, and you can stop them from bolting and running or doing something stupid with your voice and your body language. But sometimes, you know, even that, you know, even we get spooked, and we think we're calm, and then something happens to make us catch our breath, you know?
Mm.
They have the same kinds of reactions. So I think it's good to have those blinders on that harness, regardless of whether they will go without it. I'm not into really showing off for people, oh, gee, my animal will go without blinders. People say they think it's cruel to have those blinders on, but it's really not cruel, because it would be more cruel to have something happen and have to be jerking on the lines stuff like that, rather than just helping your animal by being proactive and leaving those blinders on that bridle so they can focus. it's important to have good quality harness. Oh, a lot of people will have some old harness sitting in a barn that's been there forever, and they'll put that on. But it may have weak spots in it. It might be dried out. It might be, it would be very unsafe to have harness that is questionable. He's going to be pulling a vehicle, and the last thing you want is the harness to break in any spot at all, because if it does, it affects all the different straps on the harness. The harness has to be balanced. So when you put your harness on, for instance, a decision you're going to have to make is, do I want a collar harness or do I want a breast collar harness for pleasure driving? Or am I going to use my animal for farming, in which case you're going to need a work harness? And then determining the kinds of collars that they have available, whether or not you even want a collar or if you want a breast collar. Now, I prefer the collar harness, because on my pleasure driving mules, it was less restrictive through the shoulders where it goes across the breast. When they pull, those traces are attached to the vehicle, and it gets pretty tight there in front in the chest. And when they go to step forward, it can restrict their motion and take them out of frame. It can also cause rubbing across the chest, and putting a piece of fleece over the top of it really doesn't help. Yeah. Because that fleece can rub too. Now, if you are in a pleasure class at a show rather than maybe driving on a pleasure drive cross country or something with your friends, the time that you're going to be doing it is really limited in the pleasure class. So a lot of people prefer to use the breast collar harness in a pleasure driving class because it can be cleaner looking. It's easier to deal with, put it on, take it off, and all of that stuff, especially if you're in a class that's a drive and ride class, because you can just, you know, when you're first, you drive in the class, then you pull into the center, and you've got 3 minutes to take that harness off,
really,
and connect the vehicle and put your saddle on, English or Western, and you have to change clothes because the driving clothes that you're wearing have to match the vehicle.
Oh.
And you got to change clothes all in 3 minutes and then get on board and be judged at walk, trot, and canter both directions. Line up and back. You know, in the case of the driving, it's walk, trot, extended trot, line up in the middle and back up, and then you've got 3 minutes change all this back equipment.
Oh boy.
So it's a lot less trouble to get the hames than getting the hames off the collar, unbuckling the collar and taking that down. So for the sake of convenience, you probably will want to use a breast collar at a show.
This 3 minute thing where you pull your vehicle in the center and you got 3 minutes to get to your riding outfit. Have you done that yourself?
Oh yes.
Okay,
yes,
so
many times.
And you made it within 3 minutes.
You're late getting out there that you have time pedal. And of course, when you are taking all the harness and everything off, the bridle is the last thing to be changed.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
So that's true too when you're hitching them up, you know, when you're training and hitching. You leave the halter on, get all the rest of the equipment on first, and then you put the bridle on, because you never tie them up with the bridle.
Right.
Never, never, never. You can put a halter over or under the bridle and tie them up with the lead rope. Generally speaking, when I'm at home, I even have chains at my hitch rail. I don't use ropes because mules like to chew through your lead ropes.
Oh, sure.
And so I just, yeah. So for safety's sake and for not losing my mule, I just use chains with snaps
right
on them. Carabiner snaps, because if you don't use those kind of snaps, they can get their teeth into these other kind of snaps and undo them.
Oh.
And I've got carabiner snaps and chains on every gate on my property.
Yeah.
Because they can undo all the gates, too.
Mm-hmm.
You learn these things from your mules.
Sure.
They're very, very adamant about teaching you life lessons, and they really like that.
Oh, boy.
So the other thing is, what kind of bit do you need to use on your driving bridle? I use half-cheek snaffle bits on most of my driving animals, although I have had to use the Liverpool bits with the shanks on them for some, because they can be very strong. Not that they're strong in the bridle when they're going, but if they get anxious and something spooks them, They need a little bit of extra reminder other than my voice, just pulling back on the reins. A lot of animals that are strong-minded like that will try to go through the bit. So you need the added leverage on those kinds of animals. So, but usually I don't need any other kinds of bits. I've seen a lot of other bits out there, and it's the same thing with under saddle. You really don't need anything other than the egg butt snaffle bit. The half-cheek snaffle bit fits on the harness bridle very clean, and it keeps it from slipping through their mouth because of the little bar things that hang down on both sides of their mouth. So that's kind of a nice mild driving bit for them. I suppose you could use the egg butt snaffle bit if you wanted to, but if you're in a driving class at a show, there are specific rules that you have to abide by, and they may not include your egg butt snaffle bit, and the half cheek snaffle is a good snaffle to use.
Okay.
And it's accepted by the rules. So that's the other thing. I try to stay within the rules when I'm doing all of these different events and showing, but maintain the same kind of mouthpiece, if you will, on the bit that I am using on my animal with, you know, the egg butt snaffle bit. And some of my animals need to have a mullein mouth, for instance, which is a straight mouthpiece. And the Liverpool bit that has a little bit more leverage has that straight bar, like the mullein mouth snaffle. Gives you just a hair more leverage, but you don't have to jump through a whole lot of hoops and using all these different kinds of bits that they have. And I always stay around away from anything with a mouthpiece that has something to fiddle with in it.
Oh, yeah.
Because if they're prone to put their tongue over the bit, and in the driving bridle, a legal bridle does not have a drop nose band on it. I train in a drop nose band on my driving bridles, but what I've had to do is I had to configure a drop nose band on my driving bridles by making a little leather piece loop that goes on the nose band at the top. And then I just went out and bought a dog collar for the drop piece of the nose band because it's small, it will go around their muzzle, and I'll keep their mouth shut on the bit. So then when you get to the show, you just take that piece off. But they're used to being schooled in that, so they will keep their mouth on the bit and carry the bit the way they're supposed to. But their tongue will stay in their mouth for the class. But then when you go back home again, put that dog collar back on your driving bridle when you're schooling. Because if you leave it off for any length of time, they go, oh, yeah, my tongue's loose. Oh, goody.
And that's right.
Flop it all over the place. They're very expressive, and I think that's just one way they express themselves.
Yeah.
The other thing that I will do, too, is I will school them in the elbow pull in their harness, you know, so that they are in good posture while they're learning, and all of the lessons are like that. Now, we were talking about the breast collar and the collar harnesses, and when you're adjusting those things to the vehicle, you want to make sure that your animal is probably about 2 feet from the single trees, or the single tree in the case of a cart, 2 feet at the most. Don't put them way out. If your shafts are long, you want the shafts to be at the point of the shoulder. But if those shafts take that animal beyond 2 feet at the back, that's too far out there, and you will need to have your shafts cut off to fit your driving animal so that they're at the tips of the shafts are at the shoulders, and then the back part, breeching, is only 2 feet from the single tree, maybe only 1.5 feet. Because what happens is when they're pulling, you want that cart to pull forward with their first step. And if there's too much slack behind, they're going to get a jerk on the traces and a jerk across their chest with a breast collar harness. Now, the other thing is if you do combined driving, they have driven dressage where that becomes very important that the cart moves with them. And then the same thing in their Cullen's course, which is the second class in a 3-day driving event or a combined driving event. But when you get on the cross country course, there's a lot of zigging and zagging, and I think that they must have learned that those shafts at the shoulders like that can interfere with the negotiation of the obstacles on the cross-country course. So now they make marathon carts that actually attach at the tug, that the shafts have a loop on them, and they attach right there where the tugs hang down off the surcingle rather than going all the way forward to where the collar is. And that's for the sake of this particular situation. You would not use a marathon cart in a pleasure driving class. That's just not the way it's done. There are specific rules, again, that you need to abide by. And so you will want a cart that is appropriate to the class. They do allow, the most popular cart is the Meadowbrook cart. In a show, they may have a pneumatic wheels class where you could show in your training cart. But most of the time in a single hitch class, and they will designate teams in single hitch, and you'll have to look to the rules to see what kind of vehicles are allowed and what kind of dress goes with each vehicle. Because you are going to be judged on all of those things, not just how your animal goes in harness and how responsive they are, but what do you look like? Is your cart or your vehicle balanced to the size of your animal? This is also judged. This is also important. And it's important whether you're at a show or not. Because if you were to attach your mini mule to a great big wagon, how successful would he be to pull it? You know, and especially if you jump on top, you know, and you've got so much more weight. Mm. Or to put a big animal out in front of a very small car, then have him a foot and a half to 2 feet right in front of you, and he decides to kick.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this is a consideration that you may have, and you may want him more further out in front of you so that he can't kick you in the face. But that's, again, going to interfere with the efficiency of the driving rig and the way the animal's pulling it. And if it's got a snap in the traces as he pulls forward, he's more likely to kick. So putting him out there in front isn't necessarily the right way to handle that problem. But there is a way to handle that problem. And you can do it with what they call a kicking strap. Now, we're going to go ahead and continue here and start fitting our harness. And you put your harness on with the surcingle around behind the forearms where your girth in your saddle would be, which is right about just under the gullet, 4 inches back from the forearm. So it's the girth, the surcingle, in this case, rides where the thicker skin begins to swell back into the torso. Don't tighten it around that thin skin that's right behind the forearm, because then you're going to get a lot of rubbing and chafing, and the animal will get very uncomfortable. And again, it doesn't matter if you put fleece on it. Fleece can chafe too over thicker skin.
Yeah.
You know, and I do use it on my harness underneath, even where it goes around the thicker skin. And that's how you fit, you know, your surcingle. And when you tighten the surcingle up, you want it snug enough so it doesn't really move too much when they move, because the more it's allowed to move, the more it's going to chafe. It needs to be able to sit steady. Remember, we talked about your saddle fitting that way, so that it can stay in position, but it's not so tight it's cutting them in half. And that's what you do with the surcingle. A lot of people are inclined to keep it loose because they go, oh, well, he's attached with the traces and he's pulling with that. So he doesn't need the surcingle tight or anything like that. And they get it too loose, the animal gets sore from chafing. So, and the other thing you need to keep in mind too is that the tugs that are hanging off the surcingle are carrying the shafts. So they have a little bit of pull that helps the pull and takes some of the pulling off of the breast collar. So it balances the pulling throughout the whole length of the animal and balance the, you know, that kind of pressure all the way across the animal rather than it just coming from one spot. Then when you attach your breeching, you go ahead and you do that, and you want the breeching to be, again, snug up against the butt so that when they take that first step going backwards, it actually moves the cart right away. It doesn't have slack in it that they have to back up a step or two before they hit the breeching. This is the biggest offense that I see at shows, is that people adjust that breeching way too loose.
Yeah.
It, right. need, It needs to be snug, but not tight, because the animal needs to be able to move those back legs freely. You know, we talked about that when we were talking about crippers and breeching in the trail riding. You know, so it can be somewhat snug, flash, loose, if that makes any sense, to allow the motion in the hindquarters. But it can only be as loose as it takes for the animal to move the cart on the first step. Now, we were talking about the kicking strap, and the kicking strap is attached to the breeching over the top and comes back down on either side and ties in to the shafts, but it goes right over the hips. It doesn't come forward like the breeching does. You know, the straps on the breeching come forward, and they go through a little ring there to keep that strap, that breeching, in position. And so it's kind of forward. But the kicking strap goes over the top and attaches on both sides. So if they try to go up with their butt to kick, it stops them.
Oh.
So all the kicking they're going to do, they might bounce a little bit, but again, you want it snug so that they come up against it. Because if they can't raise their hips, they can't kick you in the face. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. And then the other thing is if you have an animal that tends to be very strong in the bridle, regardless of the elbow pull and all of that, and after you have become a good reinsman, you can adjust your elbow pull in a draw rein position as an emergency stop aid. You know, you don't necessarily have to have them if your animal has been very obedient and everything. But if he's got an alpha personality and then you're going into a high action driving class, you may need that guy, as long as he's obedient, but if he may need that extra leverage that the emergency draw reins will give you in training, and then you put him in a Liverpool bit and you put your reins down at the end of the shaft to give you the shaft on the bit to give you the most leverage, but then you also get the most action from your mule when you're showing him that way, which is kind of fun.
Cool.
You know, but you gotta have one that's obedient, because otherwise it could be a wreck.
Oh, yeah.
So saying, you know, this is how you fit your harness, you adjust your harness. And when you're training, you know, backing up a little bit, takes a little bit for your animal to get used to all the things that will come up in driving. Like if you're in a parade, I mean, there's no end to the things they can be exposed to there. So you want to do a lot of work in the round pen, getting them used to all of these different things. What I did was I got them used to a PVC pole, for instance, and touching them all over their bodies. But what I did first was I got them used to the harness. I harnessed them in the round pen and go ahead and put the harness on them, tie up the traces, tied the breeching to the surcingle so that no straps were hanging or dragging, but they would feel the fit of the harness on them. So you want to get them used to anything that might touch their body. And that's what I used the PVC pole for, is I went, like I did in the very beginning before they went into the round pen and their surcingles, I used a driving whip to go in and around the legs and everything. And that was their kicking training, because there were those that never kicked, but there were those that would stamp their feet and get very irritated. And I didn't want that to go on at all. I want them to behave. I want them to learn to stand still. And I reward them for it. When they do have a kicking, you know, little fit, or they stamp their foot or something, I just say, no. And then I don't give them anything. I just stand there for a minute and then I try again. And I tickle them all over their bodies. And that's the same thing that I do with PVC pole in the round pen, in their harness. And when they're standing still and I go around their bodies and they've stood still, then I go from front to back, and then I immediately go back to the front and I give them their crimped oats,
yeah,
as a reward. And then I wait for them to chew it. Now, it's harder for them to chew the bit in their mouth, but if the bit is adjusted properly, they shouldn't have any problem. And I just wait until they stop chewing before I continue. That way, I don't have them getting all busy and forgetting that they got oats in their mouth, possibly choking on them. You know, they can do that with a bit in their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be aware of that. You know, verbal commands are really important in driving. When you do anything, you want to make sure that when you're training in the round pen and you're lunging them, that they hear those commands clearly walk, trot, whoa is what you start with. Then walk, trot, whoa, back. In the beginning, I never canter them in harness. They can do that later. That is an advanced move, and that's in preparation for the obstacle driving class that is timed. And if they are really responsive to you at walk, trot, and extended trot, go a little faster with, not really faster, but cover more ground at the trot by adding more suspension to the trot. They need to learn that in the round pen. But you don't want to have them canter in the round pen. That will come later when you move on to the next stage. Now, this that we're talking about today is all in tape 3. Of my training series. It comes after tape 2. These things are also in the Training Without Resistance manual. And you need to understand that everything that I do is done in a logical and sequential way so that your animal and you are not overwhelmed at any stage. It's a natural progression. So when you get done with tape 2, or looking, reading in the manual, part 2, it will give you the choice of whether you want to go forward into driving, which is tape 3, part 3 in the manual, or if you don't want to drive, you can skip the driving chapter and go on to the under saddle part of it and go straight into riding. When you go straight to the riding part of it, you're still going to go to the riding part of it later with your driving animal. But like I said, it comes later, and that's where they will learn to canter in good posture and everything, so that when you're good enough to go ahead and show under harness, you've already started riding your driving mule. If you decide to enter into classes, I suggest that you go into pleasure driving the first couple of years of driving and practice your trot, extended trot, walk, trot, extended trot, trot. And there is even such a thing as the extended walk. And so these are all you can find in the dressage sections of the United States Equestrian Federation training manual. In the dressage division, it breaks it down and it defines what these different gates are within the gates that are before you even reach a canter, which is a slow gallop. So you want to familiarize yourself with all these different gates by practicing them in harness, is what we're doing here, and you want to get your animal used to the commands. And what you do is, you know, if you want a slower trot, you go and trot and trot. If he starts going faster, you go a whoa trot, a whoa trot. And then you go trot, and he gets a little more active in his gait. And then you go and trot, trot for the extended trot. So you're giving them verbal commands. And you're putting them in sync with the way that they're moving. And when you repeat those same commands the same way every time they're in the same gate, they actually learn the language. Another thing you will teach your animal is ha and g. And so they need to turn left with ha and g to the right. And then one of the exercises that I do for this to make sure that they're doing this correctly, because ha and G are not just turn right, turn left, and I don't care how you move. When they turn to the left, for instance, the right foot has to come forward and pass in front of the left leg.
Okay.
And this will put them in the right position on their pivot foot to do that turn. See, this is what you should also do when you're doing your lateral training under saddle. You got to make sure that you're executing these movements the way that you're supposed to, so that you're not going to strain, sprain, or anything else, or tweak any muscles in their body. They will actually be doing it the right way, and all those muscles will fluidly move in sequence. And one of the things that I do for harness training, I teach a thing called ha round and g round, where I stand in the middle, and I play with the lines, and I will say ha round to bring them to the left, which means that they need to take that step forward with the right foot first. You don't just start pulling to the left. You release the right rein and encourage that right foot to come forward before you tighten up that left rein. See, this teaches you how to be exact in your reinsmanship. and how you are steering that animal and allowing the right kind of movement. G around is just the opposite. Allow the left rein some slack, say G around, encourage the forward motion before you tighten up the right rein, because sequence is very, very important in driving. And this is how you put your verbal instruction together with the way you want the animal to move. And you can even eventually, once he understands the basics of the lateral motion, then you can keep both reins fairly snug and just slight release on the outside rein and actually teach him to side pass. He'll be able to do that too. I do all this stuff on the ground first, and then I repeat it after they're hitched to the vehicle.
Okay.
It just solidifies the entire language, and I will be able to turn my car around anywhere I want it in a very, very tight circle where the animal is actually making the inside wheel of the cart the pivot foot. So that is very helpful when you get into these obstacle driving classes. They may or may not be timed, but when you've taught your animal this much detail in driving and spent an adequate amount of time on this groundwork, and I don't mean a couple weeks, I mean a few months, you know, so that it's really internalized with the animal, so they're really keen on listening to you. You make that animal move sideways, and you're standing behind your training cart, and you watch that wheel, and you see how they're moving it, and you don't let them go forward in a little circle. You make them turn that cart on that pivot wheel. And you think about those kinds of details. And once again, that's why it's really important that your animal size matches the size of the vehicle that you're using. And when you're training for obstacle driving, it will take place with a single hitch with the carts, but then you have the same issues if you're driving teams, only now you're pulling four-wheel wagon. But if you have trained your animal in a single hitch cart, then when he gets with his teammate on a wagon, they're less likely to take those extra steps forward, and your time will be better in an obstacle training course. And they do separate the single hitches, team hitches, you know, in both the pleasure classes and the obstacle classes. So you learn how to do that really meticulously. And at the same time, you're teaching your animal how to do that too. Now, there are a lot of different styles of carts and carriages for finished animals. And in training, you want to use an easy entry cart, metal cart, because you may have a wreck. You might just go the wrong way. They're listening to you. It shouldn't be too bad a wreck. You know, the one thing you don't want them to do is to run off attached to that cart.
Mm-hmm.
You want their experience when they're hitched to already be almost completely bulletproof.
Yeah.
Because once they run in harness and you're in the cart and they run off with it, they get panicked, and it's very difficult to bring them back, if you ever can, to ever want to be driven with you in the cart again.
Oh, wow.
They really feel like they've done something really bad, and it's a guilt that stays with them. I've seen impeccable driving animals that did not get enough groundwork training to make them absolutely bulletproof. They ran off in a class, in a show, with the driver, in the cart, and those people were not able to get their animals to drive ever again. They thought that something in the audience, something did something, and it's going to always be there. They got trained in that situation, in other words.
Right.
They learn exactly what they get taught. Mules and donkeys are like that, so be careful what you teach them. You know, that's why you want them absolutely bulletproof before you get into that cart. And do a lot of the work that you're going to do in a class, at a show, at home before you do it. I say spend at least 2 years in harness in your confined indoor arena practicing all the things that you think you might do. Because if you don't, and you're thinking, oh, it would be nice to drive down the road because, oh, he's going so well now and he's so calm. Don't think like that. This isn't about what you think about the animal. It's what the animal thinks about the situation. And when you take advantage of him by going, you know, making those assumption that he's comfortable when he's just trying to be good for you, you can run into some really, really bad situations. And I have been called as an expert witness, for instance, on court cases. And one of the court cases I had to go to was this man who was paralyzed because his team of 3-year-old mules got spooked by a dump truck while they were driving down the road, and they bolted, they ran off, a wheel got caught on a guy wire of a telephone pole. And dumped that wagon completely over and threw the man out of there and broke his back.
Ooh.
Now, the man was suing the guy in the dump truck. And I felt very badly about it. In my testimonial, I had to tell the court that it was the man's fault for taking 3-year-old mules on the road.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't believe in driving down the road where cars are at all.
Uh-huh.
Unless it's a parade where the police are blocking the cars from being there. Because you cannot depend on the drivers of those cars. And especially anymore.
Right.
When I was growing up, we used to ride down the roads. I could go 5-10 miles from my house and ride back. I could ride between towns on the main highways,
sure.
You know, on the shoulders. And people understood that when they saw an animal, they needed to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
It's rare if anybody slows down these days.
Yeah.
So you're really putting yourself and your animals at risk. And if you've got somebody with you, you're putting them at risk by taking them out onto the roads. It's just not safe. It's not a matter of, oh, gee, my animal will do this. Of course they will. Our mules will do anything for us if we're just polite about how we ask. And they try so hard to do it right because they so much want to be with you all the time. They're not like horses that would rather be grazing. You know, these guys really enjoy their time with us. And it's only the ones that are stressed or put at risk somehow, or as I say, are being used instead of sharing time with them. You know, it's all in your own attitude. And it's that thing about whether you're going to force a situation or not, or are you going to be patient and take the time it needs, that the animal needs, to cultivate that deep, abiding relationship with you and cultivate the language between you so that you both understand what each other is doing so you can respond appropriately in any given situation. Because you could get in trouble in your own driveway where you're not on the road if somebody decides to pull in too fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, it really behooves you, pardon the pun, to go ahead and do this training because you never know where these situations are going to come from. You know, in these days, you could have a plane drop out of the sky and land in your pasture. You know, and you're out there riding.
And hot air balloons.
There you go.
Yeah.
They're going overhead, and they're not always that high.
Yeah.
You know, and usually there's a whole group of them. But see, when you spend the time to do this kind of training, this logical, sequential training and taking in all these details and everything, the most important thing that he learns is to be attentive to you. And if he's questioning anything, instead of taking the flight reflex, he's got a choice. He's a mule. He can take the flight reflex from the horse or he can take the freeze reflex from the donkey. I would rather have them take the freeze reflex from the donkey so that when they get confused or a little antsy about something, their first impulse is to stop and turn around and look at me. And that's what my guys do. And so then you can go ahead, and there are just tons of things that you can do in driving. They have a lot of, like up in Wyoming, they have week-long drives where they play like the old-time settlers. And everybody gets their mule teams out, and some people ride, and they will spend a whole week driving and camping. That could be a whole lot of fun. It won't be fun if your mule is not conditioned for that kind of stress.
Yeah.
Your mule will get sore, he'll get grumpy, might start just getting unhappy with the situation. So it's really important that your mule is ready for whatever activities you're going to do. And we've talked about a lot of the classes they have at the shows for driving, you know, pleasure driving and obstacle driving and the drive and ride. They all are appropriate for animals of different sizes. They may be even broken down that way. I know single hitch and team hitches are, and I know also that they are now, with the onset of mini mules and everything, in the single hitch driving, the large standard and standard donkeys would have to compete against the mules, saddle mules, you know, size. The draft mules could, you know, they have bigger everything, bigger carts, bigger animals. So they usually break that driving class out too. Although I have seen people driving draft mules in the single hitch classes, because typically the draft mules are not quite as big as the draft horses. And in the draft horses shows, they break all the single hitch draft horses together. And like I said, sometimes they put the single hitch mules all in one place. But now with the onset of the mini mules, they actually have donkey driving. And so they will put the donkeys in a class by themselves. And they may even break it out so that they have standard donkey driving classes and mini donkey driving classes. So this is really fun. Usually the mammoth donkeys will compete with the standard donkeys under harness.
Wow.
They ask you for a walk, trot, extended trot. This is very difficult for a donkey, so you better spend some time teaching your donkey how to do an extended trot. And you need to know what an extended trot really is. An extended trot is not just a faster trot. They should maintain the same rhythm, the same cadence, with more suspension that would give them more time in the air so they can reach farther ahead with their front legs and their back legs and cover more ground. And that is something that the judges will be looking at when they ask for an extended trot. Are you just going faster, or are you truly doing an extended trot? And then once again, that's where you can get into the dressage section of the United States Equestrian Federation manual under dressage and look at their descriptions of all of these different gaits. And you can school your animal, you know, how to do these things. The working trot, for instance, is a pace between the collected and the extended trots. The collected trot maintains the same rhythm and balance, but it has more suspension. And the place where you see this abused most often is in Western pleasure classes.
Oh, yeah.
For mules and horses. They tiptoe in the back, mm-hmm. and they go slow, but their bodies are not in good posture, and they're not carrying the riders on an arc in their spine, and they are not stepping well under the torso to the center of gravity to give them the lift and the suspension they need to slow that gait down and really be in collection. Going around slower does not mean you're collected.
Right.
You need to maintain the energy of the impulsion in the slower movements by adding that extended time in suspension. And the same thing when you're asking them to go forward into the extended trot, like we talked about, you need to maintain the same rhythm, the same cadence, with a little more time in suspensions so they can cover more ground.
Wow.
And there is no other way to develop that than slow training and let those things come, because then you don't end up with a mule that's going to be stressing things out of good posture and end up with arthritis as he ages.
Right.
And then the next thing people do is inject joints so that they can move again, because they're getting calcium deposits in there. It would be better to prevent that, you know, ahead of time, don't you think?
You bet.
Well, it's lunchtime.
It is. You have a great rest of the day, Cindy.
Meredith's website is lucky3ranch.com, and you can call her at 1-800-816-7566. And I can be reached through my website, everycowgirlsdream.com. Don't forget, hit the subscribe button.
Gotta go. My mule is looking for me.
Mule Talk is an Every Cowgirl's Dream production.